From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan infrastructure is crumbling, and the governor has a solution.
We need to literally invest billions of dollars of new investment over the next several decades.
But Republican legislators say, whoa, just because the state has a little more money doesn't mean you gotta spend it.
The tendency is to go off and go on a spending spree, and that's what we gotta be careful about.
Plus, hospitals are wondering what happens if changes or a repeal of the Affordable Care Act ends Michigan's Medicaid expansion.
For the people who are, you know, have the greatest need in our state, and to lose that, I sure hope not.
And Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos is grilled by Senator Al Franken about growth versus proficiency.
But it surprises me that you don't know this issue.
And we'll look into that issue. We'll also learn about music from Wolf and Moose, sort of. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, awkward moments at the nomination hearing for Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos. And what could the repeal or a replacement of the Affordable Care Act mean for Michigan residents? Later in the program, we'll get the hospital's point of view. But first, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder delivered his seventh State of the State address outlining accomplishments since 2010 and urging investment in infrastructure. Joining us with a Democratic response is the party leader in the State House of Representatives, Sam Singh. So what did you hear with which you and your Democratic colleagues can agree?
Well, there were a few things that we could agree on. One of the key issues was around infrastructure, but unfortunately there wasn't a lot of detail given, and that's a thing that we want to see, that detail. You know, if it's something like the roads plan that the governor signed last session that basically raises our taxes but doesn't really fix the roads, you know, his own Department of Transportation came out a couple months after he signed those bills and said our roads are actually going to be in worse condition in 2025. If it's one of those half measures, we don't want to be part of that. But if it's a real comprehensive solution to make sure that things like Flint never happen again in our state, make sure that we're funding our water and sewer infrastructure, that's something we can sit down to the table and discuss.
The governor's being criticized by a number of Democrats for not spending more time on discussing the water crisis in Flint. He did spend a couple of minutes on that and then went on to discuss fixing Michigan's infrastructure, as you mentioned.
We need to literally invest billions of dollars of new investment over the next several decades. We need to look at all public and private sources for this, including fees, taxes, grants, bonds. We need to start now working on this issue, and we need to stay committed to it.
Now, the majority is going to say no more new taxes when it comes to this kind of thing. What's the Democratic response?
Well, you know, the governor's report says you need $4 billion to do the infrastructure the way he wants to do it. And so you have to take a look at whether it's investment through taxes, fees, if you need to look at bonding. I think there's a variety of different things, and we'll be at that table. But one of the things I was disappointed in was not a very significant amount of time dedicated towards Flint. Last year, he spent a significant part of his time talking about the failings of the state government towards Flint, and I would have hoped to hear more. We heard about almost the same amount of time about cows and their production of milk that we did on the city of Flint. And one of the things I wanted to hear is how we're going to deal with the long-term issues that these kids are going to face because of the lead poisoning. They have long-term health needs. They also have long-term educational needs that will go beyond the governor's term here in office. And I'd hope that by the time we get through the end of this year that we'll have a fund of some sort that can't be touched by the legislature that would really be dedicated to those young people to make sure that they have all the opportunities, whether they're health or educational, in the future. And that's something I would have hoped the governor would have talked about last night.
The governor talked about placemaking, that is, making cities more attractive to people, especially young people and employers. The criticism is that with reduced revenue sharing in communities, that's going to be difficult. And groups such as the free market think tank, the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, would say placemaking is not the job of government. How important is it to you?
Well, I'm a former mayor. I used to be the mayor of the city of East Lansing, and I know how important placemaking is. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. Revenue sharing has been down significantly. If you take a look at a decade and a half, the state government has balanced its budget on the backs of local communities. Over $7.5 billion should have flowed to local communities. They could have used that money in a variety of ways. Unfortunately, what they've had to do is they've had to lay off police officers, firefighters. We have less than 5,000 of those two different professions in the state of Michigan now because of these cuts to revenue sharing. It's one of the reasons why many communities are struggling with their long-term liability issues for their health care for retirees as well as their pension funds. So those are really significant issues. And looking forward to a conversation about some of those issues. But one of the things I did tell the governor yesterday is that my hope is that we're going to talk about how we fund local government, because this fact that we've taken $7.5 billion out of these local communities to balance the state budget means that we've really hurt those communities, and we have to figure out a way to reinvest and fix that system. It's a broken system right now.
The governor told a joint session of the legislature at the end of the speech, let's go get this done. Can you get that done when we're talking about reducing personal income taxes and making other budget holes? What's the priority for the Democrats, and how do you get things done when there's not money?
Well, there is money, and you know that's the thing we have to focus on. You know, we've told a lot of organizations, whether it was K-12 school districts, universities, cities, during the tough recession time that, hey, we're going to take some of your money right now, but when times get better, we're going to finally reinvest. And we're at that point in time. And so instead of talking about these tax cuts that the Republicans are talking about that are irresponsible, we should be making sure that all of our systems are back to square one. We need to be investing. If we want to be positioned in a global economy, we need to make sure that our K-12 system is top-notch. The governor has a report on his desk that shows that we're underfunding a school by $1,200 per pupil all across the state. You know, that's something we should have heard about last night. So instead of going forward and talking about immediately cutting taxes, when you know you have $4 billion worth of needs for infrastructure, when you know you're underfunding your K-12 system, when you're not funding higher education the way you should be, that families now have so much debt to be able to send their kids to school, we have to deal with all of those issues first before we start talking about tax cuts.
Representative Sam Singh is the Democratic leader in the Michigan House of Representatives. He's from East Lansing and represents the 69th House District. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us on.
Now let's turn to hear a Republican response to Governor Snyder's State of the State message. State Senator Patrick Kolbeck joins us. Senator, Governor Snyder said Michigan needs billions of dollars over the next decades to repair the state's infrastructure. Where or how would you get that money?
That's a good question. I think first and foremost, he highlighted some of the keys to getting the money for that infrastructure, and that is our booming economy. So the fact that we are growing more jobs here in the state of Michigan is phenomenal. So, and he also pointed out the need to grow our population. When you actually have more people working, you have more people providing taxes, and that is a very good way and a healthy way of actually promoting increased revenue in the government.
Right. The governor listed unemployment rate is down, the per capita income growth is up, population growth is up. But as you said, as when the state does better, it spends money on fixing things. So is that the mood of the legislature?
Right. So the temptation is whenever you start getting more revenue in, all the policies that you did to go off and promote those jobs that we're all looking for, because that means there's less people dependent on government, the tendency is to go off and go on a spending spree. And that's what we've got to be careful about. There's a lot of ways of going off and fixing things like roads, for example, that don't necessarily involve increasing taxes. I mean, some of it is just about building higher quality roads and using existing funds. That's the option we didn't take earlier, and despite having a very cogent, sane plan to go off and do that. So I think a lot of our citizens recognize that government doesn't always have their best interests in mind, and we got to start looking at what the impact is to our families, because for a lot of us still, I mean, we've got good income growth that's going on there, but too many of us have fixed incomes right now where it's not increasing from year to year. And yet the expenses keep increasing, like this gas tax that just popped up. Well, something's got to give. We got to find better ways of going off and spending money. We're asking our families to do that on a regular basis, but for some reason, government doesn't want to try to do the same thing.
The governor mentioned private funding. He mentioned grants. He mentioned fees and other ways to raise the money to take care of these infrastructure needs. Any of those sound good to you?
Well, there already is funding that's supposed to go towards infrastructure development right now. And I obviously, we've got some serious issues with the sinkhole that's going on, and we've also got serious issues with Flint. But those issues are not localized to those communities. But when they approach emergency status, of course, we want to go off and take care of that with funds that we've got. But when we start looking at the longer-term infrastructure development activities, we got to look at the funds that are already allocated to that. And we got to, frankly, look at funding local governments with a higher priority than state government, because a lot of these problems we're talking about for infrastructure, for these water and sewer systems, come from the fact that we have prioritized Lansing's funding, the Lansing priorities, over the best interests of our local units of government. And I think we need to shift that priority and start prioritizing local units of government.
The governor said several times during his address last night, we can do better. We have more work to do, in particular about repairing the damage done to Flint's water system. What more is the legislature willing to do to make Flint whole?
Well, I think the legislature's already done quite a bit in that regard. I think now it's a case of monitoring and doing that steady improvement of the infrastructure and recognize the fact that, you know, Flint now with some of their infrastructure, with the lead infrastructure, is similar, facing similar problems to what we face in other communities around the state. So I think that now if we start getting a mode of trying to make sure we've got a cogent policy to help everybody in the state. And like I said, I think that starts with a recognition that we need to start prioritizing the leveraging of existing funds towards local units of government. They know which sewer systems need to get fixed. They know which roads need to get fixed. If we prioritize their best interests instead of expanding the size and scope of the departments and agencies in Lansing, I think we'd be in good shape.
The editorial page editor of the Detroit News, Nolan Finley, tweeted during the speech last night saying that the speech was about fine-tuning and expanding initiatives rather than new ones, calling it second year of second-term reality. What do you make of that observation?
Well, I think there was a lot of discussion over expansion, and that is a concern of mine because I think a lot of folks are, you know, when you start talking expansion, you're immediately starting to talk about increased taxes. And that's where things are, where the governor's trying to head things with the promotion of Healthy Michigan, which is on the ropes right now, he's going out to D.C. and he's going to be going off and asking for funding, essentially, to go off and continue that project and some others.
Right. That's the expanded Medicaid program in Michigan, right?
Yeah. Medicaid expansion. Yep. And, you got to look at the expense side. And so when Nolan's talking about ever expanding government, he's right. We got to start looking at ways of actually working with the money we already have and doing it smarter. And this isn't just pie in the sky stuff. This is stuff that's really possible to go off and do. It's not the typical waste, fraud, and abuse line you usually get from politicians, right? There are practical, demonstrable ways of going off and improving services, and we never seem to look at those approaches, and we immediately go back into the kitty called the taxpayer and actually ask them for money. We need to start thinking smarter.
Senator Patrick Kolbeck is from Canton, currently serving his second term representing Michigan's 7th Senate District. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you very much. You have a blessed day.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. 2017 is shaping up to be a banner year for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. This July, the DSO goes on a three-week tour that takes director and conductor Leonard Slatkin and his 87 musicians to Japan and then on to China. Stateside Cynthia Canty recently spoke with Slatkin.
Maestro Slatkin, it's always a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
My pleasure to be back.
This is a tour that really has been a long time in the making, isn't it?
It has, but it also is something we knew we could not embark on until we had our financial house in order. We all vowed 6 years ago after the strike that we would not endanger any funding because of a tour. We would have to make sure that everything was put in place to make it possible and not increase a deficit because of a tour.
So knowing that the tour can happen, and coming on the heels of the fact that the symphony has just had, what, its fourth year of a balanced budget?
Correct. And they just announced that they have a new three-year contract.
So, as you say, the financial house seems to be in order, and it is stunning to think about really what's been accomplished in just a few short years since that musician strike.
That's correct. It's not that we still don't have hurdles to jump over. There are pressing financial needs, particularly related to endowment, that we need to have all taken care of, but at least we knew we had the funding in place, raised separately, for a tour which we have wanted to do for quite a while.
And this is the first international tour for the DSO in 16 years, and the first time the symphony has performed in China.
Yes, and the first time I will take them on an international tour.
All right, so you're giving 11 concerts in Japan and China. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little about how you plan out the music that you want to perform for these audiences?
It's a very complicated process that is not entirely finished yet. Japan has, for a long time, embraced the Western ensembles, coming on tour. I've been to Japan. I go almost every year in some capacity, either conducting a Japanese orchestra or taking an orchestra on tour. What you need to understand is that economics come into play, in that the Japanese economy, like many around the world, is not as strong and stable as one would like. So the selling of tickets, with the competition with many orchestras going, is fierce. You rely primarily on either the reputation of the orchestra, then you're only talking about a select few like Berlin Philharmonic or Vienna or something like that, or you're talking about a program in which there is a soloist who is very well known. We went that route. The two soloists we have, one is the violinist Akiko Suenai, who I've worked with for a long time. Well, she has her own festival, and she invited the orchestra to come and play, and she is the soloist. They all know her. The other soloist is a pianist named Makoto Ozone, who is known primarily in the jazz world. He's classically trained, so he's been branching out and playing with orchestras. He alternates on our tour between playing the Rhapsody in Blue of Gershwin and the Rachmaninoff Paganini Rhapsody. So knowing we had him, and that by himself he will give us good visibility and an opportunity to fill the halls, we could play around with the programming a bit. And so that's why we're able to play a great deal of American music on the Japanese leg of the tour, along with, I believe, a Brahms symphony that will go as well. But why not represent what the DSO has stood for during my tenure here in Detroit?
Mm. And then the Chinese leg will be different from the Japanese leg?
Yes, because the Chinese are still relatively new to the not only the world of Western musical culture, but new to the concept of orchestras touring on a regular basis. It's also a place where it's difficult to see people spending their leisure money on going to concerts. They tend to want to hear the standard repertoire, which is what Japan did 50 years ago. It was all Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, whatever, until they really got familiar with the repertoire. And China is at that point now. So we're still negotiating some of the details of the repertoire, especially since a few of the cities we're playing in are not the usual suspects. So we're playing in some communities which may be hearing a U.S. orchestra for the first time.
Do you have musicians within the DSO who are from China and Japan?
We have many musicians from China, many from Korea, none from Japan. And that surprised me, too, because being in my early 70s now, I saw the first infusion of Asians in this country being Japanese musicians, and now more of the Japanese have moved to Europe, playing in European orchestras. We have several Chinese, including our first cellist and one of our titled violinists and others who are playing in the orchestra. So for them, this is a really exciting big deal.
What is it you're hoping that these audiences take away from the Detroit Symphony Orchestra? I mean, there you are representing Detroit.
Exactly. And we don't really know what either the Japanese or Chinese audiences know about our city. So we come as representatives of the city. So I'm hoping that the audiences at least come away with the understanding that Detroit is not just about business, it's not just about automobiles, but it's about a broad inclusiveness. I know our players are going to be involved in chamber music events, they're going to be involved in teaching, so it's really about establishing some ties.
Well, you're breaking ground. I mean, and it's especially exciting to think that you're not going to Beijing, you're going to be in cities that this is so new. Who are some of the big players as far as funding this? This has got to be an expensive tour.
Well, we have funding from Ford and General Motors. There's some other private contributors. Actually, even though we have the money in hand, we're still trying to solicit others. There's a lot that goes into touring. The main part of it is the traveling expense. You know, we don't have our own plane to get the orchestra over there.
You're not like the Detroit Red Wings.
Schlepping 7 and 8 double basses is not so easy, and all that percussion equipment, stuff like that. You're always looking for people to underwrite certain aspects of the tour itself. anything that we get now is pretty much gravy above what we already have, but it could go to help implement other programs that we're doing on the tour itself.
The Mozart Festival, we have to talk about that, January 19th to February 5th. What's on offer?
Well, we have done three big festivals over the last 4 years. The first one was Beethoven. We had to see how that was going to go. And I think it's important for people to understand why I decided to do this. February, and in this case January, is a little tougher time for sales because a lot of our subscribers, patrons, donors, aren't here. They have escaped to either sunnier or even snowier climes. So it means we have to rely more on a different kind of ticket buyer, a different kind of public. And I thought to focus, at least for a few years, on a single composer and a single body of works with many events that go on that are either related to the concerts or related to the composer. Some fun, some serious. Like last year during the Brahms Festival, there was a Brahms beard growing contest. That kind of thing.
Indeed.
So we did Beethoven, we did Tchaikovsky, and we did Brahms. And we incorporated and played all the symphonies by those composers. The obvious composer to do next is Mozart, but less obvious is what we would play.
Yes.
The reason for that is simple. Mozart wrote 40 symphonies. I know that the last one is listed as 41, but nobody's ever found symphony number 37, so we don't know if it exists. Clearly, we're not going to play 40 symphonies in the course of 3 weeks.
I think not.
No.
So what have you chosen?
To make it a little bit different, but similar to what other ensembles have done, is symphonically to play the last six symphonies, which are generally considered to be the summit of his symphonic writing. They're all very different. They all have a degree of familiarity and popularity. What is very different is that we also decided to play every piece he wrote for solo wind instrument and orchestra. That means one concerto each for flute, oboe, bassoon, and clarinet. There are four concerti for French horns. Each one is being played by a different member of the DSO horn section. That's pretty impressive, actually. Then there is the flute and harp concerto. But we also added into the mix the ensemble concertos. There's what I consider to be one of the most sublime works in all of music, the Sinfonia Concertante for violin, viola, and orchestra, and also his Concertone, which is for two violins and orchestra, and there's a couple short pieces he wrote with orchestra, and along the way there's some overtures to fill in the time as we need it. So it's a nice portrait of the composer, both familiar and in some cases unfamiliar. There will be our usual mascot, obvious name of Wolfie. There will be Mozart beer on hand. There'll be the Mozart cookies. There'll be Austrian souvenirs. There'll be probably a dancing polka contest or something along the way. The whole idea is to give a true festive atmosphere to something that you call a festival.
Go to DSO.org to get all the details on the Mozart Festival, because there's free events. Well, it's a vibrant and exciting home stretch for you as you prepare to step down in 2018. We'll certainly look forward to talking with you, Meister Slatkin, and after China and Japan. It'll be exciting to hear all about how that went. Maestro Leonard Slatkin, Detroit Symphony Orchestra, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for taking time with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. That is the music of Predator and Prey, of Life on Isle Royale. You are listening to Data turned into music. Data from the Isle Royale Wolf Moose Project. It's a remarkable way to present research done by Michigan Tech professor John Vucetich and his team of students. Cynthia Canty recently spoke with him.
This is a project tracking wolves and moose on Isle Royale, and it's what, been going on for some 5 decades?
That's right. We're coming up on 6 decades now, but yes, that's correct.
Why is Isle Royale such a good place for these kinds of studies?
Well, two reasons. One is that it's simpler than many other places. Simpler in the sense that on Isle Royale, there's a single top predator, that's wolves, and then a single prey item, that's moose. Most of the rest of the world is more complicated. It has more predators, more prey, and so it's more things to try to figure out. Isle Royale, with that single predator and single prey, makes things just a little bit easier for scientists to understand. The other thing that's important is that neither of those populations are hunted, and so we get a sense of how these populations might behave when they're not influenced by humans in that way.
Now, this otherworldly music that we just heard, that actually came from data researchers have collected?
Yes, that's right. The origin is this long time series, this long tracking of how many wolves and moose there have been on Isle Royale over each of the last 50 years. And so that's the data, and that data becomes notes. They become notes in this musical composition that we heard a little bit of.
And this is called sonification.
Sonification is one way to call it. The other, it's sometimes known by the phrase data-driven music.
Hmm. All right. We're going to listen to a little bit more of the music of it's the wolves, the moose, and the climate of Isle Royale. And as we listen to this, I'd love if you could kind of guide us through what it is we're hearing.
Sure.
All right. Let's take a listen. This is a blend of three separate sound patterns.
Yes, that's right. And there's one track for the wolves, one track for the moose, and then one for the climate. The wolf time series, or the wolf data, is represented by a dulcimer-like instrument. And the moose abundance is represented by the pulsing rhythmic synthesizer that you can hear in the background. And it goes, for both of those tracks, they go up and down in volume as the abundance of the wolves and the moose go up or down.
And then the climate changes in there too, isn't it?
Yes. Climate is represented by a couple of things. There's some, if you listen closely, there's some beating of the rain, and the velocity of those rain beats represent elements of the climate. And then there are some other notes that are not tied to the dulcimer or the synthesizer, and they're also reflected there. You know, there's a few other features of the music too. One of the things that's happened, and this is going back and forth between the science and the music, from the science perspective, the wolves have become increasingly inbred over time. And the students who assembled this sound for us, they inserted some reverberation, increased reverberation to represent this circumstance when there was increased inbreeding for the wolves. So there's some little extra features like that as well.
This is fascinating. Who got the idea to convert data to the sounds? I mean, did you even know the students had come up with this idea?
No. You know what had happened is at our university, we have a Department of Performing Arts, and a person named John Luther Adams, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning artist, musician, had come to Michigan Tech, and he has pioneered some of these ways of data-driven music. And so these four students, they were seniors, undergraduates, they were so inspired by that visit that they thought that they would assemble this project as their senior project. And they did the entire effort without my knowing about it at all. And then they, with their instructor from the performing arts, and they kind of laid it all on me all at once after it had been done. And John Luther Adams had taken a look at it as well. He'd helped them fine-tune a couple of the details of it all. And so that's kind of how it came to be. They were just so inspired by both John Luther Adams and the Isle Royale system itself. They wanted to put those things together.
I have to ask, what did you feel when you heard this for the first time?
Oh, my gosh. A great deal of joy. And the reason that I felt joy is because, and this is just speaking to my own personality, but I like to understand the world around me, and I like to understand it in as many different ways as possible. And I'm a scientist. That's what I'm skilled at. But science really is only one way to know the world, and in particular to know nature. And so art is a different way to know the world. I'm not an artist or a musician myself. I don't excel in those ways at all, though I appreciate it. And so it just struck me as an opportunity to reflect on Isle Royale in a way that I never had dreamed of before. And I've been thinking about Isle Royale for a long time, and so the chance to experience it in a different way was really rich for me.
Well, let me encourage everyone listening to us talk right now to go to the website, isleroyalwolf.org. And if you look under the technical link, it'll take you to the sonification. And it's so cool and interactive. You can play with slider bars that let you adjust and isolate all three sound components. You can kind of create your own mix, if you will. And it is really beautiful. Is this the first time that anything has been done like this, to your knowledge?
This is the first time anything has been done like this with the Isle Royale Wolf Moose Project. As I had mentioned, another person who has really led the way in this is John Luther Adams. He has done something up in Fairbanks, Alaska, where he has taken different sounds of the environment, and this has ranged everything from very minor seismic movements of the Earth, the aurora borealis, other kind of climate features, and he's turned that into an orchestral kind of an experience, and he's written a book about that as well. And so we're really kind of following his lead. And I should say, you know, what's challenging and interesting about it is that it's technically rigorous because you have to have both the computer savvy and the musical knowledge in a technical sense to take numbers and turn it into the music, but you also have to make it sound attractive as well. And so you can kind of think of it as like tuning the instrument. You know, the instrument is what it is and the notes are what they are, but you can still tune that instrument to make it sound attractive. And so it really is right at that interface between science and art, and that's another reason why it's so fascinating, I think.
Well, kudos to your students, and I do encourage everyone to go to isleroyalwolf.org and hear it for yourself. John, it was great talking with you. Michigan Tech Professor John Vucetich, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it was great to share the time. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. President-elect Donald Trump's choice to head the Education Department went before senators yesterday for her confirmation hearing. There were a lot of questions for Betsy DeVos, some about her Michigan family's donations of millions of dollars to Republican candidates and whether she'd mandate public schools become charter or private schools. But it was an exchange between Minnesota Senator Al Franken and DeVos that caught our attention.
And I would like your views on the relative advantage of measuring, doing assessments and using them to measure proficiency or to measure growth?
Well, thank you, Senator, for that question. I think if I'm understanding your question correctly around proficiency, I would also correlate it to competency and mastery, so that each student is measured according to the advancement that they're making in each subject area.
Well, that's growth. That's not proficiency. So in other words, the growth they're making isn't growth. The proficiency is an arbitrary standard.
If they've reached a level, the proficiency is if they've reached a third grade level for reading, et cetera.
Talking about the debate between proficiency and growth.
Yes.
And what your thoughts are on them.
Well, I was just asking to clarify then.
Well, this is a subject that has been debated in the education community for years. And I've advocated growth, as the chairman and every member of this committee knows, because with proficiency, teachers ignore the kids at the top, mm-hmm, who are not going to fall below proficiency, and they ignore the kid at the bottom who, no matter what they do, will never get to proficiency. So I've been an advocate of growth. But it surprises me that you don't know this issue.
Joining us now to discuss this is Joshua Cohen. He's associate professor at the Department of Education Administration at Michigan State University. Let's first define those terms. What is proficiency?
Proficiency is a target that sets a minimum level of achievement where all students are expected to meet a certain threshold, essentially, that defines them as, by definition, proficiency in that particular subject.
So how's that different from growth?
Growth is basically customized for individual students based on what they scored before. So what we're doing is measuring distance from point A in the student's academic career to point B.
Has this been a big debate within the education community, this growth versus proficiency debate?
It has, particularly when we are thinking about what the best way to measure school progress is and to identify which schools are struggling, which are doing really well. That's where the debates become particularly heated.
This is a discussion that might be happening in most teachers' lounge, then.
Certainly in school districts. I would think teachers are aware of it, yeah. Intuitively, if not by name, right? I mean, all teachers understand that they do have some goal to get kids to a certain level. We call it, say, on-grade reading. But teachers also want to know and to have the ability to respond to how kids are coming in and to pitch the education that they're delivering to those children over the course of the year based in part on how they've come into the classroom, not just on sort of some goal at the end of the year.
How familiar should a nominee for Secretary of Education be with this growth versus proficiency debate?
Well, it's not for me to say what the nominee should or shouldn't know. I'll just say this, that in the future, if she's successful in her confirmation, she will become very familiar with this because it is an important debate and it's going to continue to be.
So this is something you're teaching your students right now, that you should be aware of this, you should know how to measure this, and you should keep both of these ideas of growth and proficiency in mind as you bring your students or as you teach your students.
Both concepts are important, again, and they're different ways of reflecting the same type of information we're trying to get at, but it actually is different types of information.
I guess I should ask you, is there a better way or a worse way, or is it you must have both?
I like to look at both. We tend to talk about what schools do for students, right? We tend to say kids come into the classroom and they learn. And the growth metric tends to be a better reflection of that if that's our goal. So let me give you a quick example. If one school, 75% of kids are proficient in 1 year, and the next year they've made very little progress on that, 78% are proficient in that next year, is that school contributing more to student learning than a school who had 50% of kids reading on grade in year one and went all the way up to 70% in year two? It's not quite how we measure growth, but you can see conceptually that what we're trying to do in the growth framework is understand how effective the schools are at contributing to student learning. If that's our goal, then growth is the better option. But we can't completely disassociate it and say, well, there's no benchmark at all. Particularly as children get older, there are certain content and certain materials we do sort of expect it collectively as states or as school districts for the kids to know. And so asking the question, how, are they at that level or not, is a reasonable question. It's just a little different than saying, did the school bump them up that way?
That's Joshua Cohen. He is an associate professor at Michigan State University and the Department of Educational Administration. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Thanks very much.
We continue to examine what the repeal of the Affordable Care Act could mean for Michigan. Today, the hospital's point of view. Laura Oppel is a senior vice president and chief innovation officer at the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, the MHA. Stateside's Cynthia Canty recently spoke with her about Obamacare and the impact it's made in the state.
Good to have you with us, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
We hear so much and have heard the president-elect and leading Republicans talking about we're going to repeal and we're going to replace the Affordable Care Act. What does that actually mean? I think there's a lot of misconception floating around out there.
The repeal of the Affordable Care Act is happening as we speak, but it's kind of a two-part answer. To completely repeal the ACA as it was signed into law in 2010 would probably require 60 votes in the Senate, and there aren't 60 votes to do that. However, there are 51 votes to work at repealing a number of things that have to do with budgetary change. Things like the individual mandate could be repealed, or the employer mandate to require certain employers to provide coverage. The medical device tax could be repealed. The Cadillac tax on high-cost insurance plans could be repealed. Things that can't be repealed under what's called budget reconciliation, which only requires 51 votes in the Senate, are things like allowing people to stay on their parents' insurance up till age 26, or prohibiting insurers from rescinding someone's insurance coverage after they've made a claim. You also can't probably repeal the requirement that insurance policies have no lifetime benefit caps. So some things could be repealed using budget reconciliation and others can't.
As we go forward and we talk about repealing Obamacare, it's very clear that we're not sure exactly what that's going to look like right now.
We are not sure.
Dismantling it, would that be good or bad for Michigan's hospitals?
We've always had a number of issues with some number of provisions in the Affordable Care Act. Dismantling, however, the coverage expansion that we were able to achieve for nearly a million people in Michigan, I think that would have a huge impact on those people who gain their coverage, and by extension, it would have a huge impact on the hospitals that serve them.
How so?
people have been able to achieve coverage, you know, over 600,000 people are now covered by the Healthy Michigan Plan, which is the Michigan model for expanding Medicaid and requiring people to financially participate in the Medicaid expansion, as well as more than 300,000 people who now buy insurance through the individual marketplace. We're almost certain that the folks on Medicaid were previously uninsured. If they were unable to have that coverage and then need it for any type of health care, certainly a serious health care problem, but even modest health care issues, I think it can be a barrier to people seeking care, which lends itself to difficulties with your health, which in turn makes it hard to, you know, sustain your family. Having people come to the hospital without an insurance card and late in their illness is not the best outcome for anyone.
Because I've got to imagine that since we saw these nearly million Michiganders covered under the Affordable Care Act, have we seen fewer people using emergency rooms for primary health care since the ACA took hold?
We don't have that data yet. We do know that about the same percentage of people with commercial coverage use the emergency department as people with Medicaid coverage. So there doesn't seem to be a disparity between people who got expansion and people who use commercial coverage. What we do know is that the number of people who come to the hospital without some type of insurance card has decreased by 50%. We also see that the rate of uncompensated care, the burden on hospitals to provide care for free, has gone down dramatically as well. We still have a fairly substantial amount of uncompensated care, but the pressure on hospitals to figure out how to deliver all the services that communities need at the same time that they're trying to do it without being paid, that's lightened up a bit.
It's helped hospitals improve their financial health, if we will.
Improve their financial health, and by doing so, allowed them to keep delivering the services that people need in certain communities. I don't have any statistics, but anecdotally, we have not seen any more hospital labor and delivery services close in the last several years. We have actually seen some hospitals start adding some services, especially around urgent cares or, you know, other primary care services. I think that hospitals have some financial flexibility to come up with different ways to offer care that are more suited to the way that people need care today.
What kinds of hospitals have been most impacted by the ACA, for better or for worse? I'm wondering, you know, between rural or urban, large or small, what do you hear?
Every hospital has been impacted by these ACA. For example, in the Affordable Care Act, there was a provision that allowed for a program known as 340B. The title isn't specifically interesting, but the impact of it is that's a program that helps small and or struggling hospitals to pay for the prescription drugs that they need to use in their hospital. Many large urban hospitals use it as well. It kind of depends on your volume of Medicaid and your uncompensated care and all of those things. The ACA extended that to our critical access hospitals, and those are hospitals with 25 beds or fewer. Michigan has either 35 or 36 of that type of hospital. And being able to get better pricing on the prescription drugs that you use inside of a hospital makes a huge difference to hospitals who have relatively low volumes, but, of course, you know, fixed costs that most hospitals have to deal with. At the same time, the more urban hospitals see the much higher levels of Medicaid and had very high volumes of people without insurance. And to be able to expand Medicaid and the individual market and have people come with coverage, not only because they had an insurance card, but also because we could get them into a system of organized care where they could have a medical home and start getting regular treatment for different types of problems that they might have through our Medicaid HMOs. It's not uniform what the impact was, but I can say uniformly everybody had an impact.
Laura, critics of the ACA point out there are some 25 million Americans who are not covered by it, and we saw premiums and copays and deductibles that many feel are way too high, and despite President Obama's initial promise, there are people who were not able to keep their doctor. From the perspective of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, what problems does the MHA have, if any, with Obamacare?
If I could have fixed anything, I would have been the staffer that would have said to the president, don't tell people if you like your coverage, you can keep it. Because in so many instances, coverage decisions are not made by individuals. They're made by their employer, and people don't have that control over that. So that probably wasn't the finest hour of Obamacare. That said, well before the Affordable Care Act, we were moving into the world of high deductibles, copays, increased premiums for workers. That was going to happen, and probably, while it's difficult to prove the negative, I would guess that we could look back and do some research and maybe find that we kept premiums from going up more than they would have without the Affordable Care Act. But again, you know, I don't have the statistics to bear that out handy. Things that we would have probably fixed are there were some policies in there around payment and some, you know, new payment designs that came at hospitals very quickly, very fast, without a lot of testing and without a lot of evidence. We probably would have slowed some of that. We are very much in favor of innovation here at the MHA, but throwing up 100 ideas without waiting to see what is really effective, we would have probably changed that sooner rather than later. In terms of the number of people that were not covered under the ACA was never designed to get 100% coverage. There were always people that, you know, were going to be left out, including people who are not here legally, people who have religious reasons for not wanting to participate. While it was, you know, we'd all like to talk about universal access through universal coverage, that probably wasn't going to be possible. Hospitals overall committed to a contribution of $155 billion over the first 10 years through reductions in our Medicare reimbursement. We knew that that wouldn't get us a complete coverage, but we thought it was worth the investment to get the expansion that we did.
Is there anything that you have heard from Senator Mitch McConnell or other Republicans that gives you any encouragement of what a replacement plan might look like?
No, I've read Speaker Ryan's Better Way plan, and there's just not enough details there to understand what they might do in a way that would improve on the system that we have right now. And I'm not saying that the system we have now is perfect. I'm saying we need improvements. And I am concerned about the level of financing for Medicaid going forward. I think there's a lot of interest in reducing the cost of Medicaid. We would say that there's a lot of costs that go into serving our population that aren't even recognized yet. So before you reduce the cost, I'd like to recognize the cost. What I would say is I'm hearing a lot out of the Senate and to some extent out of the House about people who are saying, you know, we can't just get rid of the individual mandate, eliminate the taxes and other things that support this, and then say, you know, don't worry, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, we'll figure out something else and you know, trust us. A lot of people are speaking up about the need for a replacement plan to happen sooner rather than later and to be well-defined before they finish the work on the budget reconciliation, and I think that's very encouraging.
If we think about, for example, Healthy Michigan, which, as you say, some 600,000 Michiganders, low-income people, qualify for health care, if that goes away without a replacement, what's it going to mean for people?
Oh, I hate to think about 600,000 people losing their coverage through Healthy Michigan plan after we finally got it. I think that's heartbreaking. You know, those are mostly single adults, people that we didn't cover in Michigan. In Michigan, Medicaid used to be what one of our former Medicaid directors called a poor and program. Even if you were a parent, you couldn't be above, I think, about 40% of the poverty level and qualify for coverage. You had to be poor and a parent, poor and a disabled, poor and maybe a caretaker relative, maybe a grandmother who was taking care of your grandchildren or something. If you were married or single and didn't have any of those responsibilities or disabilities, there was really no way for you ever to qualify for Medicaid, regardless of your level of poverty or income, that we could finally, in our state, take care of people with at least, you know, a health care benefit despite those circumstances. I think that's a real credit, and it was a bipartisan effort. Our governor stepped up on that. We had a couple senators who were very active on that, then Senator Roger Kahn and Senator Mike Shirkey, who led the way, and, you know, many Democrats as well. It was a terrific accomplishment for our state, and for us to go back on that, for the people who are, you know, have the greatest need in our state, and to lose that, I sure hope not.
Laura Oppel, who is Senior Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer at the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, the MHA. Laura, we want to thank you for being with us on Stateside.
I really appreciate having the chance to talk with you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, and the audio engineer was Rusty Brock, who's always messing around with my sound. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Cass Adair, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.